Welcome to a new episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital money and helps you understand how digital assets and money will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Jonas and today I'm joined by Tristan Thoma. Tristan has worked on various national digital currency projects. For example, Tristan lead the project team introducing Bitcoin as legal tender in El Salvador and also worked on many more projects in this context. He is living also a digital nomad life, which I think is very interesting. And Tristan always has a lot of energy. So it's also something I appreciate and I try to match on my side. So it's a really great pleasure to have you with us, Tristan, today to talk all things digital currencies with you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me, Jonas.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming. So what we will cover today, we will primarily discuss your insights on global digital currency trends, talk about previous projects you have been working on, for example, in El Salvador. And we will discuss also your kind of key lessons learned on all these initiatives. And we also dive a little bit deeper into your current projects. And I'm also very interested in a little bit, at least how your life as a digital nomad looks like, because you travel a lot and yeah, it's always exciting. But this is not the key topic of the podcast. It's just a side conversation we might have. But let's get started. So how did it actually happen, Tristan, that you came to the topic of digital currencies? And when was it? Like, what fascinated you on this topic?
Yeah, I started actually getting involved in about 2015. And Bitcoin, honestly, Bitcoin, crypto. I was studying industrial organizational psychology and computer science because I love people and I love trying to figure out how the heck people work and think and organize themselves. And I see technology as a way to amplify people's powers and help for people, ideally. Most of my background prior to working in blockchain and crypto and this kind of tech world was social impact. So I worked with a mindfulness company focused on spirituality and, you know, meditation, save the world kind of thing. And then I took a bit of a turn going into technology and blockchain, but I really see it as a lot of the same things. And that has actually come out to show with some of the work that I've done and some of the impact really that blockchain has in the world. And so I got involved in this because we want to change the world. We want to make it better. And this is a great tool, considering the way that blockchain works from an organizational standpoint and an incentive standpoint. It incentivizes people to collaborate, to actually work together, whether they want to or not.
Yep.
And one of the things you learn about people is you kind of need to put them in that situation in order for them to work together. So 10 years ago, I got involved. 2016, I started working on it full time and I started teaching. Just what is Bitcoin? What is blockchain? How does it work? Hashing nodes, you know, cryptography, distributed databases, chain code, things like this. And things just kind of organically escalated from there.
So basically, like your key motives also to go into this domain was A, that, I mean, the technology just fascinates you. So you have also seen, you know, what you can do to the greater good, let's say, using blockchain technology, and then also to, you know, to just work with people, because as you said, you like people.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Nice. Good start. And I mean, when we chat, Tristan, you know, you're kind of always all over the place, but also always at different places. So as I said, you know, you also live, as far as I know, like you don't have like a central location you're living for years, but more like digital nomad type of life. Like, where are you currently diving in for? Or where are you living? Are you living somewhere?
I live in the present.
That's the meditation Buddhist response, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Honestly, it is pretty tough, I'm not going to lie, living as a digital nomad, not having a fixed long-term place. But I often just try to go where I can be the most impactful or the most helpful. For the past year, I've actually been in Bolivia, which was an interesting and unexpected turn, honestly, in my life story. But I got in touch with one of the ambassadors of Bolivia to the EU. I was living in Brussels at the time last year. And they told me that the country's changing, the money is, devaluing. And Bolivia had actually gone through a hyperinflation process in 1982 to 85. This is the second worst hyperinflation case in human history, behind, Zimbabwe or something like this, right? One of the others. So their money system is changing in real time. And it's going to change in the next 18 months. A new president is coming in. So I was kind of given some background on Bolivia. And actually 10 years ago, just before I started working in crypto and blockchain, I co-founded a nonprofit focused on education based in Bolivia. So working with kids in jails, hospitals, and schools, just teaching them kind of education, mindfulness, really. So I have a bit of experience with Bolivia and how hard it is to access money there. Just literally, it's hard for us to fathom in the developed world, the concept of not being able to get money. Like, yeah. I can't get a dollar, but instead I can only get this other local currency that devalues. And it devalues faster than the dollar. And then I can't really get Bitcoin. There are no on and off ramps or formal exchanges. And it's just really difficult to access money, which somebody, an economist there actually, when I arrived, used a very powerful term that I won't forget. She said, this is like oxygen. We need this like oxygen. We need money like oxygen because we have to eat and we have to pay our rent and we have to import gas. We have to, as a country, we're a net importer. It's a landlocked country. So literally dollars is the way they access medicine, right? Tylenol or more critical medicines. They don't produce all of that domestically. And if they don't have access to dollars, they're not going to be able to buy it and import it. So it really is like oxygen. So trying to figure out the money problem, right? Fixing the money system is as serious as it sounds. So it's been an amazing opportunity to learn about the whole financial system in that country in the context of our money is changing. Our money doesn't serve us the way it used to for the past 20 years. It was at a fixed exchange rate. And the central bank supposedly had done the job it needed to and then didn't. So I kind of just arrived on the streets of Santa Cruz and was like, okay, let me try to figure out the money system.
Let me just figure out the money system and let's change Bolivia and change the world of payments.
Exactly. We'll see what we can do to help. And I mean, ultimately, it's a Bolivian solution that will be the difference maker. And it's a Bolivian country that will experience it. But there are some very unique experiences and insights and technologies that they don't know about. They just don't understand. Most of the world doesn't understand the power of digital currency. And I'm really happy to be on this podcast because on both sides of the table, people don't really understand, right? From the traditional side, people look at Bitcoin and they say, oh, the Bitcoiners want it to the moon. Well, yeah, sure. There's the concept of Bitcoin appreciating in value, but there's an absolute mountain of value that has nothing to do with the market price that is Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And that's what Bolivia and the entire global South is understanding through the power of stablecoins, through the power of different networks and real-time payments. So it's a bit of an exploration that everybody is doing. And I see the global South and places like Bolivia with millions of people that need oxygen as the place where this is going to make the biggest impact in the next 2 years, right? Europe, the dollar, the euro, like there are banking services. There's access to money, there's access to credit, there's access to finance. And I think the global north will watch what the global south does with digital currency in this kind of leapfrog process. Watch and learn, take less risk, which is the proper way to do it, and see what happens. Because yeah. Bolivia has to. Bolivia doesn't have a choice. It's oxygen or oxygen. It's oxygen or death. Yeah. And so their financial system is updating, and I'm happy, lucky to be a part of it.
Yeah, and I mean, that's often, to be honest, just on something I guess we all forget, also living here in, you know, advanced economies where, you know, you always get the question, like, what does now blockchain technology really solve? You know, payments are working well, you know, why does it now need this Bitcoin thingy? You know, isn't this just another volatile asset here and there, right? But if you're on the ground and if you experience the problems that are there in the financial system, which of course is there more in developing and emerging economies, then you see which problems this technology and this innovation can ultimately solve, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a talk I often give around lessons of the first national digital currency system, right? That was in El Salvador. And we can jump into El Salvador a bit more in context and significance, because there is an absolute misconception and misunderstanding about what happened in El Salvador from the aspect of macroeconomics and money systems. People, again, focus on their individual pocket. How much money did I make in Bitcoin in El Salvador? That's not the purpose. But one of the real things that happened in El Salvador is we got to see the power of crypto versus banking. And when you take a cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, and make it legal tender, does it undo dollars, right? Because El Salvador is a dollarized country. Does it undo the banking system? A lot of the kind of perception on crypto people, right, or Bitcoiners or whatever you want to, you know, call it, is they're anti-banks, is they're anti, you know, anti-traditional systems, anti-financial regulated systems. And yes, there are those people, but that's not the power of the innovation. That's not the real innovation there that happened in El Salvador. And that's not the real shift that occurs when you adopt a cryptocurrency on a national scale. There are actually two things, critically, from a human systems perspective, that it does. It's an on-ramp and it's an off-ramp. It's an on-ramp for people who are unbanked and want to access digital financial services. I am a Salvadoran. I don't have a bank account now for whatever reason. Either I don't trust it, or it costs too much, or the minimums, or whatever. And with a cryptocurrency, all you need is internet, right? You have an address on chain and you have a wallet that accesses it from your device. So from my perspective as a person in the world, I can access the financial system with the absolute lowest barrier to entry of internet. And then I can access the whole global financial system through that, through DEXs and then onboarding and formalized exchange and VASP and CASP and all the things and stable coins that we say. But the fundamental is it's an on-ramp for all I need is internet, and I have access to the world of digital finance, including credit, lending, cards, et cetera, et cetera.
That's, and I guess, on-ramp. Also financial inclusion in El Salvador, or exclusion, is pretty high, right? So
yes, at the time of 2021, when the wallet was originally launched, the banking rate was 34%. Mobile money rate, mobile wallet, was around 11, I believe.
Wow.
Within 3 months, I usually say six, but the actual is three. Within 3 months, we doubled that. The country doubled that. I don't want to take all the credit, because ultimately it was, you know, it was Naib's initiative. And I came in after the initial launch. There were some technical issues. So they brought me in to kind of recreate the infrastructure in the back end, the connections with the banks and the ATMs and the payment processors, the QRs, point of sale devices, AML, KYC, right? So we updated the whole system, and that was my role for a year and a half. But on the banking side and financial, the on-ramp side, the significance of it, we had 74% of the country on that wallet in about 3 months. And from a financial inclusion perspective, that increases GDP. You can account for more of the money of your country on chain digitally. Therefore, you can account it in your GDP. You can account for volume and velocity of your economy once you have access to that data. And so this type of mobile wallet, whether it's Bitcoin or not, we'll get to the Bitcoin part, but just access to mobile money through this tool is an absolute win.
And I guess it's really a no-brainer that you want to increase financial inclusion in an economy.
Yes. Every economic development study ever, look at the writings and studies and the work done by the IMF and the World Bank on economic development. And every single one of them starts with this process of bring people into the system, give them access to the system, let them understand and explore the system. When I say the system, it's the formalized system, right? Bitcoin is a lot more formal than cash. Whether or not the central bankers want to acknowledge it, it's on chain. There's a history. There's a record. There's a formality to it. There's data that can be extrapolated from it to represent, you know, activity. And all of the studies say you start with financial inclusion, you go through education, and you end up with a developing economy.
And I think you also mentioned there was a second aspect beside financial inclusion, right?
Yes. The first one is on-ramp for the unbanked. The second one, and I learned this in Bolivia, for better or worse, I'm not going to talk too much about the political atmosphere in the US or other countries, but I see it in Bolivia, and in addition to being an on-ramp for the unbanked, it's an off-ramp for the banked. It's an off-ramp for victims of political and economic turmoil. There is political turmoil. There has been. I'm Jewish. I know you're in Germany. I love Germany. I love spending time there. And I think actually in the context of financial freedom, financial sovereignty, political freedom and political sovereignty, there's a sentiment of we want to enable and empower and enforce or protect really is the right word, protect sovereignty, right? People. We want to learn from the past. I think Germany has done better than most places actually in the entire world and history, learning from the past. But in Bolivia, they're under a socialist regime for 20 years. Part of the reason why my work there is valuable is because they were not given access to global money, i.e. crypto. And so they're stuck on bolivianos, on this hyperinflating local asset that's tethered to the whims of their political incentive of the person running the country at the time, at the moment. So there was an announcement last year. There are dollar accounts in Bolivia. The banks offer dollar accounts. People can no longer access those dollars. So even if you have $100,000, your entire life savings, whatever, $10, who cares the amount? You have your life savings in this asset that, yeah, it's secure. Dollars are generally pretty stable, but I can't access it locally because I don't have access to my own money, not my keys, not my bank, right? And the announcement came from the central bank that I cannot take out my dollars in dollars. I have to convert them at the central bank exchange rate into bolivianos if I ever want to access that money. And that exchange rate has doubled. So I lost half of my life savings in one announcement from the central bank of the country that I live in because of where I live, because of the central bank's mismanagement of their foreign national reserves, or because of their political policy. So we see it in real time. This is serious. This is money. This is oxygen. Crypto is the opportunity for people to own their own money. It is absolutely critical that the ability for self-custody wallets is enabled in every jurisdiction in the world because I think it's a human right. If I could own cash in my hand, if it's legal for me to have cash in my hand, it should be legal for me to have a self-custody wallet. And crypto acts as this off-ramp for victims of political and economic turmoil because eventually people screw up, governments screw up, and people suffer as a result of that. It's not right. That was part of the original thesis behind Bitcoin. I wouldn't call myself a Bitcoin maxi person, right? Even though I've connected a country to it, I just care about people, right? Keep the focus on people, and then your priorities remain clear. You should have an on-ramp for the unbanked. You should have an off-ramp for victims of political, economic turmoil, local turmoil. That does not negate in any way the value and critical nature of trusted financial institutions like banks and central banks. Still fully support them. Most of my work is for them and that formalization of this, you know, economy and systems. And at the same time, you just need to recognize these things happen in human nature. So as banks create standards and regulators create law, keep it in mind. Not a lot of people think of it in that way. Not a lot of people talk about the importance of this. But if there's something that comes out of this work, I really, really hope it is the enablement of self-custody wallets, self-custody assets, right? Non-government digital currencies. Bitcoin is one of them. It's not the only one, but those better be enabled. Those better come out of this process that we're in right now of crypto adoption, crypto exploration.
And that's so interesting what you're saying, Tristan, because what you kind of explain from the practices, I think exactly what we also discuss in the Western Hemisphere, you know, in Europe, in the US, but more from an academic perspective. So what I mean by that is a topic of monetary sovereignty, right? I think that's currently the key topic in the EU when it comes to money. So ECB trying to push the digital euro to say, look, we need an alternative payment infrastructure. What, you know, will we do if, you know, some foreign countries do not allow us to use their kind of payment platforms anymore, right? Think about fintechs, think about credit cards.
Yeah.
So that's exactly like the same problem that that one wants to solve with a digital currency solution. But again, just from an abstract perspective, because we haven't seen this situation in place. But of course, if the situation comes, we are screwed, because then it's way too late in this regard. And the second thing in this regard is also like what you just said on self-custody, because we've also seen that with, when President Trump came into office, that he and also in the political landscape, like the self-custody of, approach should be fostered, should be supported more. And so this is interesting, because you explained this from practice, and these concepts, right, also appear here in Europe with very, very high relevance, but more from an, theoretical perspective, or to avoid potential situations like this in practice.
Yeah, I'll call out respect and appreciation for that acknowledgement. I think Europe has done probably more than the US on trying to learn from history of best practices. US, Americans generally were a little haughty, a little arrogant, not going to lie. I'm American, so I get to say that. And in the process of just trying to figure out what's best, what's the best for the most amount of people. And yes, we do need to institute AML practices. AML does stop bad things, right, from happening. It exists for a reason. And trying to tread that, thin line of not overreaching into financial sovereignty, but at the same time, not allowing anarchy is a tough thing. And I think as long as the decision makers, the designers maintain both extremes in their consciousness at the same time, then the optimal solution will be arrived at, right? Somehow make systems that can be formal and enforce AML practices, at the same time allow people to have their own self-custody. That's tough. Generally in organizational psychology, right, systems, there's this kind of conversion or inversion between convenience and privacy. If it is less private, it's more convenient. And if it is less convenient, it's often more private. And I think that cost is something that we should allow the market to arrive at. In Bolivia, we see the same thing. You can self-custody wallets. How many people do it? A small percent of the people that take the time and energy and effort and risk to self-custody their assets. And
it's also about security, right?
Totally, totally. I have some amount in my self-custody just because I know the value of it. But the majority of my funds are in banks or custodial wallets because they take the time to invest in that security. So great, I take advantage of that. That's wonderful. To that extent, I give up my privacy for that convenience and security. And that's a wonderful median to make. It's a wonderful handshake for us to have.
But I think what is important, and also here, Tristan, like your work you're doing on education, and for us, of course, the same with the podcast, is to give people an understanding that there is this choice, right? So everybody can decide for him or herself, do I put this into self-custody, not into self-custody? Do I care about privacy or not, right? But if they don't know about their options, how should they evaluate this just somehow close to, in a reasonable and proper way?
Yeah.
It's impossible.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I was speaking with some of the designers from, I'm not going to call them out, let's just say large banks. And they were designing kind of L1 solutions of blockchain-based payment systems, RTPs. And they were saying a wallet needs to be whitelisted in order to hold assets on the system. And I'm looking around like, yeah, I get it from the AML registration perspective, but that's not blockchain. That's not crypto. It is using blockchain for RTP. I agree with that. But it's also difficult to find that middle ground. And I think that as these systems are made, as long as people are informed, then we get to make conscious choices. I will use it because it's great. It's connected. It's secure. It has insurance. It has all the, protections. And as we're making systems for people that don't have the wherewithal to make that evaluation themselves, let's say, a lot of people in Bolivia as an example, let's just make the systems as good as possible. Access to the best and access to the worst. That's part of what a good, considerate, responsible system includes.
So the value that you see on using blockchain technology for payment use case, or also put differently, basically to set up national digital currencies based on blockchain technology, if I got you correctly. So A was really that this can help a lot on the financial inclusion front. So basically a social goal one can achieve. The second one is that it provides like a sovereign form of money, so that you are not dependent on other countries. You have mentioned the example of Bolivia, where you cannot access US funds, or at some point you can, but you have to use the current exchange rate, which after the announcement kind of, you know, changed a lot. So basically your funds are kind of halved overnight. And thirdly is just the aspect, I mean, it's also kind of sovereignty, but more individual sovereignty, that you can use your funds in a self-custodial way, independent of somebody else, so that somebody can't give you away. So it's a lot about freedom, I would say. Would you agree? This is the three key value propositions?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And when it comes to national crypto systems in general, I would shift the focus away from, very candidly, the conversation is either stablecoin, CBDC, or Bitcoin, right? As far as national currency systems, nobody's talking about Solana as legal currency, as legal tender, right? Permissible for payments. And I think that's an important part. But if we want to take some more example or inspiration or understanding from El Salvador, lessons from that country that made Bitcoin legal tender, the majority of the transactions or adoption, it's in dollars, right? People want money they can trust. And I have this conversation a lot around, like, was El Salvador a success or not? You know,
would have been my question as well.
Yeah. A lot of people have that question. And if you ask Michael Saylor, and if Michael Saylor knew all the numbers, then according to perhaps his you know, framing of Bitcoin or the project, I would say no, right? The adoption of Bitcoin as the daily currency for transactions is very low. From a fintech perspective, if Bitcoin were a fintech and it were trying to get adoption in El Salvador, it would not have majority market share. So I wouldn't consider that like a success on, we're trying to convert the world to Bitcoin. But that's the wrong question. It's the wrong question. The question is not, can we get the world on Bitcoin? The question is, can we get the world on global money systems that allow for the benefits that Bitcoin offers and interoperability with the financial systems that we know and trust? Well, yes. It was an absolute success. We connected more than double the amount of people with bank accounts now have integrated Bitcoin accounts with dollars. The majority of those transactions day to day occur on dollars. Wonderful. Fantastic. I know the general purchase price of dollar is going to be today fairly similar to what it will be tomorrow and what it was yesterday. I don't have that same assurance with Bitcoin, and that's totally fine. I have different benefits with Bitcoin. So if my perspective as a human is to make a system that allows the on and off ramp and allows access, it's an absolute success. We doubled financial inclusion. GDP increased more than double digits in that year of adoption and has since offered through access to data about volume and velocity of the economic activity in El Salvador. The IMF just came in with a $1.4 billion loan with more confidence that that El Salvador will be able to repay that because there's money on the books. It's formalizing the economy. The question is the country Bitcoin is the wrong question. The question, is the country empowered? Is the country in a better place than it was before? The answer is yes. So I think the framing on the question is very important. And a lot of people get that wrong, very candidly.
I mean, the increase in GDP is just remarkable, right? So also given times where currently there's, you know, a lot of geopolitical turmoil everywhere, import, exports, kind of flows are reversed whatsoever. Like, would you say that this is like causally related to Bitcoin, so that there is causality? So I'm just asking because, of course, I mean, I'm too far away so that I can judge what else happens in this year, right? Because a lot of the Bitcoin Bitcoin skeptics, they said, look, this was a very smart marketing move from El Salvador to do this, right? And they were also very successful in attracting foreign investments from the Bitcoiners, right?
Yeah.
But not from the rest. But can you say how much is attributed to Bitcoin? Like, I know it's impossible without an analysis, but do you have a feeling for that?
Yeah. I'll say first a general statement and then go into the detail. The general statement is that in a country perspective, right, we're talking crypto for countries. I'm actually writing a book, Crypto for Countries. But when you think about crypto for countries, and in particular, El Salvador is one of three or four countries in Latin America that does not have its own monetary policy because it's already dollarized, right? So since 2001, it was dollarized. 20 years prior, Panama and Ecuador are similar. So their central banks already don't have sovereign monetary policy. They are subject to the purchasing power and the whims and the faucet of dollars from the United States. That relies on the reliability of the dollar. And so from a country perspective, President Nayib Bukele, I think, did a brilliant move doing this because he's not anti-dollar. He's not anti-banking. He's not anti-anything. We're not replacing dollars, or El Salvador is not replacing dollars, but they added to that basket of, honestly, also political and economic liability that the country, or exposure that the country has. So right now, since President Trump came into office, I saw a statistic, and I hope I'm not misquoting here, something like 17% drop in general purchasing power in the dollar. That's tough. That's heavy, right? I mean, between you and I and the listeners, Bitcoin's purchasing power has gone up. So I don't know if it could be...
Bitcoin fixes this.
Yeah, I don't. It can... Bitcoin's general purchasing power has gone up, and the dollar's general purchasing power has gone down. And so including this different type of money asset in the system, just so that it's technically enabled and people have access and optionality to it, that sounds like a great move. If I were a president and I wanted to help my people, you know, hedge potential future 5, 10, 15, 20, 50, 100 years down the line, at some point, right, the dollar purchasing power will probably go down. Bitcoin purchasing power might go up. I don't know. But if I offer access to my citizens to optionality, that's a great leadership move. It's a great leadership move. So thinking geopolitically, if I already don't have my own sovereign monetary policy to my central bank, and I see a different type of money is accessible, offers the on and off ramp, offers dynamics, offers DeFi, offers whatever it does, it makes sense to make it available to my citizens as a great leader. And again, most of it's still on dollars, most of it's still on banking, it being the, you know, economic activity. But having that optionality, I think, is a great leadership move from a geopolitical perspective. If I'm not President Trump and my country does not rely on my own currency today, that's the general. The specific on Bitcoin investment into El Salvador, there are a lot of actually, I was on a panel last week or 2 weeks ago with Juan Carlos Reyes, who's the president of CNAD, the regulator in El Salvador, the crypto regulator for El Salvador. And I mean, they oversee new offerings, new companies, and obviously activity in crypto in the country. But also out of that, out of CNAD has come a lot of regulation and oversight of those investments that are coming into El Salvador, right? So if somebody's buying a house in San Salvador or in, I don't know, Bitcoin Beach, right? You could buy it in Bitcoin and you can still have those transactions be formalized. I saw firsthand a ton of people coming in. Yeah, some of them bought with Bitcoin and some of them invest in Bitcoin. But beyond that, there's the general knowledge of the undertone, which is accepting of multiple currencies and multiple denominations. We're not tied to exclusively one. And that does increase investment, right? You have a regulated environment. I think the statistic was like, Juan Carlos, we'll bring him on the next podcast so he can give the statistics. But they reject most of the applications for digital currency systems or licenses or things. I mean, it's regulated. They do a great job regulating and creating law and definition and clarity around, we allow this, we don't allow this. We allow transactions and responsibility, and we don't allow scams. Great. So have a team that's educated on traditional banking, educated on crypto, knows the differences, knows the environment, and those should be the people that are building up the country. So in that sentiment, I think they've done a pretty good job.
That's interesting to hear, because often, and I mean, this again, the Western view, right? There is so much, it's just skepticism towards this, right? So that often people say, look, just go to El Salvador and you can open a company, you know, and don't need a lot of requirements. But what you're saying is that's definitely not the case. So they will very explicitly check what you're doing. And if I'm not mistaken, like, didn't Tether move their headquarters to El Salvador as well, right?
Yeah.
So they are... officially based there as well. So if I understand you correctly, Tristan, what you are saying also is that from this GDP increase that took place, there is really a Bitcoin effect. So that some part of this fraction is driven by the introduction of Bitcoin, or, you know, of the system where you can use Bitcoin and dollars. I think you made the distinction very clear.
For sure. It's great to see. I hope other places, I mean, this is not to say that I agree with everything El Salvador does or everything that, you know, President Bukele does. But from a leadership perspective or a macroeconomic political perspective, I think there are some really good moves and lessons to be learned around the world of what to do and what not to do, right? We all have a history and an experience, and the best humans are the ones that learn from mistakes and learn from patterns and learn from history to make the future better. So through the bold move that they did, and that was unique to El Salvador, Bolivia is not doing the same, right? I wouldn't suggest to the president to make Bitcoin legal tender in Bolivia. I think, you know, the system is not ready. The system is not there. The economics are not there necessarily that Bolivia would need to or should make Bitcoin legal tender. It can allow it as payments. Right now, after the loan from the IMF, one of the stipulations from the IMF, obviously a dollar institution, is that, you know, limit the requirement of Bitcoin as legal tender in El Salvador, right? And I had a really interesting conversation with the prior chair of the SEC about this one of the times I was in DC, and they asked the question, did Bitcoin need to be legal tender in order to do all this? Or could they have just, you know, passed a permissibility for payments, right? You can receive it as a formal form of payment, even on the government, you know, side for liabilities on taxes. That's one of the key instruments of legal tender. And the reality is yes, right? They could have made Chivo or the Bitcoin type of integration without making it legal tender, just, you know, make a framework for permissibility of payments or custody. And there you go. You have the basic framework for people can have and use any kind of money. That's great. Global money. People are now connected. El Salvador, I think the legal tender part was a bit of a political, you know, political marketing, but it worked. In its own way, it worked. For future countries, I don't think a lot more countries will take the same stance of legal tender, but seeing the outcomes of specifically selecting the benefits that have come in El Salvador from Bitcoin's integration, allow custody, allow payments, allow, you know, make a framework for its use and investment. There you go. You've empowered your people better than they were yesterday. Congratulations. And you have not negated the current or existing systems. And you shouldn't. You shouldn't negate 100 years of banking practices that came out of lessons of consumer protections, because ultimately regulation should be for consumer protection to take care of people.
Yeah. And this people component is often missed, I guess, in some of the stuff.
How do we miss the people? We're all people. This is all for people. I mean, yeah, PETA, we like animals and environment and all that stuff. But come on, money was made for people. To interact with people so that people can help people. And whether we categorize those people as ourselves in the mirror or our family or our neighbors or our countrymen or the people on the other side of the earth, it depends on the context of how you see people. But the best way is global. So use global money. That could help people too.
You already mentioned some aspects of Bolivia on the environment. So it's currently a very, very challenging time. So new government, monetary system currently kind of being reimagined. You also said that it's not, you know, like on, let's say on the table, or very likely that here Bitcoin will be introduced in a similar way as it was in El Salvador. Like, how are you currently helping like the folks in Bolivia? Like, you know, what options are then kind of on the table, or what is currently explored? I mean, of course, depending how much you are allowed to and want to tell us and the listeners.
Yeah, Bolivia has a lot going on. So I've been there for a year now, and the government is going to change in approximately 3 weeks. There's a presidential election coming up in 3 weeks. And so up until now, most of my work has been in the private sector. We've worked everywhere from the banks to clearinghouses to credit unions, securities exchanges, on an advisory capacity on how they build systems, how you apply AML responsibly, KYC, update accounting, you know, core databases need to account for digital assets, which have their own exchange and liability and legal status and reporting and compliance and reconciliation practices. So the banks need to learn this. And that's been my focus over the past year. In the past couple months, or the past few months, I've gotten closer with the presidential candidates. So working with the parties that are coming in, and really across the board, just to empower education and best practice. For example, my company, or we hosted an event in the Legislative Assembly. You were at. You came and spoke at. So
right.
Thank you, Jonas.
You were so kind to invite me.
Yeah, we had some digital attendance. And so, Jonas, thank you for coming to speak in the Assembly about regulation and policy around cryptocurrency, CBDCs, stable coins, understanding the map, right? Everything starts with education, which the unfortunate part is that education is boring. It's not sexy. It's not lucrative. It's not, you know, the 10x kind of skilled tech SaaS
thing
so that
necessary.
We like. But it's what that's people, man. Yeah, education is about what people know, and people make decisions and people make law. So we've put a lot of effort into educating people on the ground in Bolivia, regulators, banks, wallets. And our current conversation with both of the parties is after they take office, they're going to have a challenge because their central bank has effectively run out of resources. There was an announcement, one of the national newspapers, I was walking around La Paz maybe about 3 weeks ago, and I saw a newspaper, I wish I had it with me. It said something to the extent of Gobierno del MAS deja el país sin oro ni recursos. Like the government of the prior political party is leaving Bolivia with no money, no gold. That's tough. I mean, it's the result of corruption and it's the result of mismanagement waiting between.
And it's bad if you have a peg to the US dollar, right? So if you're not even having your own monetary policy.
Exactly. Well, in Bolivia, they have the Boliviano, so they have their own currency. They're not U.S. pegged. They're not U.S. Well, all foreign national reserves are largely U.S. dollar backed, right? But in their case, they've over-collateralized their gold. They've over-collateralized their foreign reserves in an attempt to maintain a fixed exchange rate, which, you know, from some monetary policy perspectives, completely makes sense. But also they've mismanaged a lot of the subsidies from gas, oil, and other parts of the economy. So this new government is going to have a process, what we believe will largely include tokenization of natural assets. That's a large conversation in Bolivia. Bolivia holds 30% of the world's lithium reserves, period, of the earth in one landlocked country. And lithium obviously is in every phone and computer and EV and everything. So a lot of the perspective now is, well, Bolivia can either go into a really tough situation of economic contraction, the whole economy. Bolivianos will be taken out of the market. Dollars will be taken out of the market. The whole economy will contract and go into a bit of a depression. Or we can use technology in innovative ways, tokenize futures on lithium for investors that need it and access liquidity for the country in the shorter term. We can onboard that as a project and a process in and of itself is something that there is already precedent of, right? Billions of dollars of bonds have been issued on chain, and that allows for institutional management or global oversight of these assets once it's on chain, right? use a normalized structure. US and Europe has already done that. Middle East has already done that. Asia's already done that. We're doing natural resources. There's a bit of a tax question that comes within the implication of issuing or recognizing natural resources or futures or contracts or rights on chain. But in Bolivia's case, I think that will be an inevitable process that they will go through. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the conversation there is how do we support that being done responsibly with global best practices?
So the work you have been doing then on the ground for a year was really a lot about, I mean, of course, identifying the right stakeholders, talking to the right stakeholders, educating them, kind of laying out a strategy that you, I guess, kind of hope to kind of, let's say, execute with the right precedent in place so that you can basically help the country, Bolivia, to use this novel technologies like blockchain technologies for a greater good, like for payments, you know, like in the context of stablecoins, but also what you mentioned in the context of tokenization when it comes to lithium and others, right?
Yeah. On the stablecoin side and payments, it's actually, we have a conversation taking inspiration from El Salvador, actually, because Bolivia's economy is 80% informal. Well, estimations around 80%. So GDP right now is, let's say, 40 wow. billion. If that's only 20%, because GDP can only account for what's been accounted for. You don't know what you don't know. And if estimations say 80% of the economy is offline or off chain or off record, then we're talking that 40 billion is only 20%, right? This new president, if done right, could create a type of national inclusion system or national currency or financial infrastructure system that doubles GDP within his term. That would be historic in the world of economic development. It would benefit the country. It would benefit the people. There's, of course, devil's in the details, man. I mean, how are you going to tax all this? People stay informal because of largely tax and compliance and AML and all the, you know, trust.
Yeah, and also don't, you know, force people to use it. Otherwise, you get this freedom and privacy bucket not fulfilled.
It's a tough balance to try to strike, but I see no better use of my life. I see no better use of time than millions of people getting access to things, to oxygen, the things they need. Right? Global money, get out of this hyperinflating or leverage or underwrite this hyperinflating asset with tokens and then give people access to a new Boliviano that has underwritten by the wealth of natural resources of the country. You actually can bypass an economic disaster in Bolivia. So you asked earlier, why the heck am I in Bolivia? Sometimes I ask myself that. And the answer is that country has the opportunity to create precedent for the rest of the world of tokenization, financial inclusion, of economic development, but at the same time as showing ways that self-custody and traditional financial systems can be integrated in a way that's not anti-banking, right? Not anti-banking, not anti-dollar, not anti-fiat, not anti-government, but yes, resilient to the ups and downs of those systems, because Bolivia is experiencing it right now in real time. We don't know what's going to happen in the US or Europe or Middle East or petro or dollar or any other kind of digital asset, right? Money. The question of money is on the table here. I love this podcast and I love speaking with you so much because you think in this way is we're designing money. We're redesigning money. 1971 was a redesign when the dollar left the gold standard. Right? Bretton Woods was a redesign of money, establishing the dollar as the global currency. Well, it's happening again 50 years later. So let's take a response.
And I mean, we are exactly in this process, Tristan, aren't we? Like, so if you, again, it's always what I'm saying in this podcast, and the listeners are probably bored when they hear this again. But if you zoom out with Bitcoin, where we stand currently, right? So which companies have this built up, like ETFs, the most successful ever. We have countries that introduces legal tender, but also have them in their balance sheet. If you look into, obviously, El Salvador, also Bhutan and others. I mean, we currently do have the leading financial conference, Cybos, here in Frankfurt in Germany. And everybody is posting on stablecoins, like even bank CEOs now are getting crazy on stablecoins. So a lot, of course, hype also around this one. But you see, we are currently in, and there's Literature Euro, by the way, as well, right? So there is so much stuff happening here. And that's also why I'm personally super excited to be exactly at the forefront. And for you, it seems even to be, you know, you're more on the forefront because you are, you know, physically in Bolivia, talking to the stakeholders, basically doing this full time. And I also really appreciate the work, Tristan, you're doing, because you also seem to be very, very driven, you know, from the inner side, you know, to make this a better place, to empower the people. And this conversation also shows that it's, you know, this you can like Bitcoin like I do, you know, like you do, without being a Bitcoin maxi and saying, you know, Bitcoin to the moon, and just being happy when Bitcoin reaches 1 million. That's not the point of all of that.
Yeah. I often say, depending on what circles you're in, this kind of goes over better or worse, but the only maxi that I am is people. And I would advocate for that across the board. We want to take care of people while doing it sustainably. And if you increase the context of taking care of people to generally all people, they live under systems. We live under financial systems. In Europe, the financial system works pretty well. That's awesome. As much as I would love to come and join you and live in Germany, and it's, you know, there's nice life there, even New York or Miami, where I was living before, that's not where the future will be determined. I think that Europe and the United States will watch the global South refigure out money over the next couple of years. And money is oxygen, man. I mean, living in everything's so monetized these days. Everything is monetized. You can't walk down the street without spending money to freaking survive. So it's like, this is your food. I mean, if you're a farmer and your land is shifting, right? The content of the land where you get your food from is changing. You're going to be all over that. You're going to be testing it. You're going to be knowing it. You're going to be caring for it. You're going to be seeding it. You take care of the land that provides your food. And in this case, not everybody has access to that land to grow their own food. But how do we get food now? Money. So if your land, if your money is changing fundamentally, you should pay attention and you should be involved in it. And you should make sure that it's being tilled in a good and responsible way. And if you're on the side of the central bankers or the regulators or the system creators that are providing the land, that are providing the actual money, that's a big responsibility. And you really, I appreciate your perspective and approach and the gravity that you undertake this type of work with, because this is money for billions of people. And it's going to impact the entire next generation.
And talking about the next generation, because it's a very, very good transition actually to my last question, Tristan, because I really enjoyed the conversation. It was so cool to really hear from, you know, people on the ground, you know, and you've been in this space for 10 years. So it's just so cool. And we should definitely do this again, because I think we completely went off script. So I think I have a single question.
I have a bunch of other notes that I ask you. We can go to them 2 minutes now.
Exactly, but we can do and we should do this again. But because you're now in this space for 10 years, you have seen a lot, right? You worked with a lot of different countries. You like people, so you work together with a lot of people, a lot of different stakeholder groups, a lot of, you know, different religions, political spheres, whatsoever. But what are kind of your key advice when it comes to young people? So, you know, because you said, you know, money is oxygen now. Like, you know, if I'm now a young person, a student, I'm listening to this podcast, like, what should I take from this conversation after this 1 hour?
One of my favorite quotes that's inspired me for a lot of my career is, ultimately, nobody knows what they're doing. We're all figuring this out. There are people that do know more. So if you don't know what you're doing, learn. You can know what you're doing. And that goes on scales, right? I know what I'm doing with key management. Right? I know the risks and I know the implications and the structures of these systems. So be informed and educate yourself and try stuff. But also at the same time, I mean, we're 8 billion people in the world that only know what we know. Use AI, because AI knows what those 8 billion people generally know, even though not all the context is uploaded to the cloud yet. Over the next few years, we'll get there and we'll have super intelligence. If I'm growing up now, I would get to know AI and get to leverage AI to access the information of the world, of humanity. And I would definitely question people's context of their assumptions and the way they go about things. And at the same time, recognize that things were built for a reason, right? people generally do act logically. So whether or not I like AML rules, it exists for a reason. Whether or not I like the structure of a political system or a financial system or something, it exists. It was generally built for a reason, probably not the reason that you initially think. So if you want to change something, research it, use the information of the world that's now available through AI, and talk to people, because people are the ones that make decisions and change the world. And they use technology and systems. So educate yourself and question people. And hopefully the things that you make and take care of people.
No, this is super, super inspiring. And thanks for sharing your insights, Tristan. I really liked this conversation, and the time really passed like very, very quickly. This, I can't believe we had just been talking for one hour already. And really now the very last question is, you know, if people say, look, this Tristan guy is a cool guy, I want to follow him, like what he's doing. So where can people learn more about you and your work and kind of stay up to date on what you're doing?
Yeah. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, honestly. It's not the sexiest platform, but I get a lot of information from there and always available on LinkedIn. Our website is imperastrategy.com. You can see some of the things that we do in our kind of general work. I'm on Instagram. I don't use it that much. I'm trying to get more into the socials. But yeah, reach out. Best probably kind of cold outreach is LinkedIn. And I live on WhatsApp outside of that. So I'll give my number over LinkedIn, and we can connect and do stuff like that, like how we connected actually, Jonas.
Perfect. Yeah, and this has really been already some time back, so definitely add this in the show notes. And again, thanks Tristan for taking the time. I know you're also super busy and always in different time zones, so really appreciate you coming to this podcast and make this episode work. It was really very, very fascinating discussion.
Pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, dear listeners, also thanks for joining this episode. I hope you liked it. If you did, please recommend this podcast further to your friends, your family, your colleagues, whoever you think should listen to this podcast, is interested in the future of money, and we will hear us for our next episode in a week. So in this sense, have a great rest of the day, and bye-bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.